Well, good evening, everyone. And I'd like to welcome all of you here to the final colloquium for the fall 2000 Ivry Colloquium Series. Before I introduce our speaker tonight, I just wanted to briefly mention a few commercial notes. One is we're in the process of putting together the spring colloquium series. We don't have it finalized yet. At present, it looks as if Charles Zimmerman from Biblical Seminary will be giving the talk in February. And I don't have a title yet, so I can't give you the details of that presentation. In March, Dave Bossert's going to be back giving another talk, a follow-up to this series called A Fit Place for Life. If you haven't gotten the idea yet, this will be, what, number six or number seven?
Probably number five.
Number five in the series. He told me originally he had planned a series of seven, so I'm trying to guess at where we are in this thing, as he explores a little more fully this concept of basically creation and the biological development of life from the perspective of a physicist and a Christian. It's been a very interesting series that we're seeing. In April, we will have Fred Putnam speaking, and he plans to do a presentation on Bible translation, which ought to be really interesting. What are the nuances? What are the efforts? What are the kinds of choices and decisions that have to be made going through the process of translating the Bible from the original languages into one of the modern spoken languages here? And in May, I'll be presenting an Ivry lecture here, basically that's derived from the THM thesis that I'm currently working on. And it will really be an examination of the process of hermeneutics or biblical interpretation, taking Job 42:6 as the text, since that's what I'm working on. So we hope that we'll have sort of a balance between some practical theology from Charles Zimmerman, some scientific insight from Dave Bossert, and then some biblical studies. So we hope that any of you who are available to attend will feel free to. We should have the schedule posted on the Ivry website in early January. Hopefully everyone will get back to me by then. I'm still waiting for a couple of titles and abstracts. And now what I'd like to do is take a moment to open this talk in prayer, and then I'll introduce our speaker. Heavenly Father, we thank you, Lord, for your goodness and for your graciousness and for your many blessings that you've poured out on each and every individual who is present here tonight. We thank you, Father, for the men and women, Lord, who have diligently studied your word, who have sought to know you better and to produce scholarly works to enrich the lives of the church, Lord, which is called by your name. We thank you this evening, Lord, that our speaker was able to make it here safely, Lord, as he's traveled down from New Hampshire. And we pray, Lord, that you will help each of us, Lord, to appreciate the insight that he would bring us this evening. Help us, Lord, all to think about our faith in a practical way. Help us, Lord, to integrate our everyday life, Lord, with our spiritual commitments and our trust and confidence in Jesus Christ. I just thank you and praise you, Lord, and I ask you to be with us this evening. In Jesus' name, I pray. Amen. Amen. And now it's my great pleasure to introduce to you Dave Bossert. Dave received his PhD in mathematics from Dartmouth College way back when.
64.
How was that, 64? I wasn't even going to guess a date. Following that, he has been involved in a number of areas in research in the areas of both physics and mathematical analysis. And so he held a position as an operations analyst for a while and eventually formed his own independent consulting company where he did a lot of creative things like looking at artificial intelligence and working with government contracts. And finally, after having done all of those things, he's now in a position of being retired, and he finds he has some time to devote himself to some scholarly studies, which are his passion. And the series of lectures that we've been receiving are the fruit of some of that time and effort and passion. And tonight we're going to hear a presentation entitled The Chemical Building Blocks of Life. I might also mention that Dave is an active member of Ivry and on the board of directors here and sort of my co-conspirator in getting the Ivry website together. Without his really diligent work in converting a lot of these documents to HTML format, we wouldn't have nearly the content up there that we do have. And so without further ado, here's Dave.
Thank you, Barb. I want to pass this around. Take one or two. I mean, if you're really hungry, take three. But don't eat them yet, because I won't get to that till towards the end of the talk. But that's for our purposes of an illustration.
If anyone didn't get a copy of tonight's talk, I'd be glad to pass one out to you.
This talk is one of a series of talks that probes the question, what is life? And this particular talk, in turn, concerns the building blocks of life, which we will describe in a few minutes. The first talk, some time ago, concerned the creation of the elements and noted that one cannot just create any old elements in any old universe. There are a number of very precise things that must happen in cosmology and physics so that life can occur. This is the essence of the anthropic principle, the subject of a number of investigations since the 1950s, when the Nobel physicist Fred Hoyle, may I have the slide, marveled at the fine-tuning of certain physical constants. Later, reviewing his life, Hoyle remarked, "A common-sense interpretation of the facts suggests that a super-intellect has monkeyed with physics, as well as chemistry and biology, that there are no blind forces worth speaking about in nature." A later talk concerns the right chemistry for life. This talk notes the fact that water and carbon, together with a few other elements, but especially these, are absolutely essential to have life of any sort, whether on this earth or in some alien abode elsewhere in the universe. Don't misunderstand, not just life as we know it, but life of any sort. Well, maybe I should hedge a bit. I mean any kind of advanced multicellular life, or as someone has said, any life able to pose the question, what is life? So there is water. Water, water everywhere. Life is saturated with water inside and out. And carbon, to make stringy molecules called carbon chains. There simply is no other possibility. Liquid ammonia, for example, doesn't support life. Or sulfur or silicon in place of oxygen and carbon. That's the point of the last talk, and we won't revisit those arguments here. Beside water and carbon, there are a few other elements that are needed for any kind of life. Nitrogen, phosphorus, sulfur, and a dozen others figure prominently in the cell processes mentioned here. We will not argue for their necessity, just use them as they are appropriate. All the needed elements are available in the atmosphere or in minerals that make up the Earth's surface, and all occur in forms that are soluble in water, which is good, because that's how they're transported to a cell. Now the question before us is this. Okay, you have water, carbon, and these other ingredients. Now what do you need to start building life? We will proceed as follows. Next slide, please. First, we will survey all of life to see how many varieties of life exist. Next, we will look at the most basic feature that is found in all of these various species, the genetic process called the central dogma. Thirdly, we will look at a number of representative species from the simplest to the most complex to see how much genetic code is needed to specify these species. After this survey, we will ask three questions. How simple is the smallest, presumably simplest species that can be imagined? Are other radically different forms of life possible? And is it plausible to hold the view that life is a random product of undirected natural causes? What kind of experimental demonstration is needed to support such a view? Incidentally, if you're following my paper, I might skip over things because I have to condense this a little bit. So we're going immediately to section one. Within my lifetime, the accepted way to group living matter has changed twice. Early on, I was told that life falls into two kingdoms, plants and animals. This division was a bit subjective and sometimes led to endless and perhaps fruitless discussions about whether such and such is a plant or an animal. I myself sometimes got caught up in that. And so some biologists devised an objective way to look at living species based on microscopic cell characteristics. In this scheme, all of life is divided into prokaryotes and eukaryotes. Eukaryotes have cells with an internal structure called the cytoskeleton that supports a proper nucleus and other internal organelles. Prokaryotes are everything else. Now, when the eukaryotes were recognized, it was just noted that they have a nucleus and the rest, okay? The genetic codes in the nucleus and the rest. The thing is, that is actually hides a much more extensive difference between prokaryotes and eukaryotes. Eukaryotes do not have a nucleus, so the genetic code is looped around throughout the cell. The step from prokaryotes to eukaryotes marks a vast increase in cell complexity, reflected, as we will see, in the size of the genetic code. The step also marks a vast increase in capability. In my view, the jump in complexity from a prokaryote to a eukaryote is comparable to the jump from non-life to a prokaryote. To give just one example of this jump in complexity, next slide. Eukaryotes have a highly developed transport system to move food and waste around the cell. The cytoskeleton, which is shown in the top figure there, forms highways along which special transport molecules called kinesin move, carrying along the food and waste from source to destination and using a complex dispatching system to keep track of things. Now, until very recently, no one was able to see the cytoskeleton because it's very, very minute. So that picture is the result of putting some phosphorus markers on some otherwise invisible lines throughout the cell. That's a picture of a single cell. You can see the nucleus. And the kinesin, here's a cartoon of it that was in the New Scientist magazine in 1999, shows the kinesin molecule walking along one of those filaments, moving a sack full of food or waste or whatever, and it just moves these things along like a highway, physically moves. I mean, you actually see it moving. It's all happened by chance, of course. In contrast, prokaryotes have no transport structure. Molecules move about within a cell by ordinary diffusion, the way a drop of dye would spread through water. This is only effective if the cell size is very small, and so prokaryotes are all very small. Eukaryotes, on the other hand, can be large because they have an efficient transport mechanism. Single nerve cells, for example, may extend many feet. This division between prokaryotes and eukaryotes lasted until the 1970s, when some very strange life forms were found, species that live in extreme environments, such as around hot vents in the deep ocean, in deep rocks, or around geysers in Yellowstone National Park. It was thought at first that these species were heavily adapted prokaryotes that had evolved to survive under harsh conditions, but that view did not survive what happened next. About the same time, a new way to look at relationships between species arose. Historically, the tree of life was built by looking at morphology, the appearance of different species. That is what you usually see and hear described in various museums of natural history. But in the 1970s, it became possible to study the detailed structure of the genetic code by a process called sequencing. Species could be compared by looking directly at the genetic code. Species that are very closely related have genetic material that looks very similar. And the similarity decreases the more remote the relationship. This is the basis of DNA testing that is done in criminal labs today. When sequencing was applied to the strange creatures of extreme environments, and as more and more species of them were found, they appeared to be closer to the eukaryotes than the prokaryotes. And they did not appear to be adapted from prokaryotes. And in the final analysis, they differed so much that they were called a third major form of life called the archaea, or archaeobacteria. Could you bring it down just a little bit so you can see the three domains? Another thing happened. Because they thrive in extreme environments, very hot, very salty, highly acidic, and so forth, it was thought for a while that the archaeobacteria were carryovers from the earliest living matter, which accounts for the name archaea. Because the earliest life forms must have had to cope with similarly harsh environments. But genetic studies do not support this. The extreme species are far too complex to be that primitive. Because of the lack of clear evidence of ancestry, the modern way to order these domains avoids putting archaea at the bottom, and in fact, none of the domains is at the bottom. The relationship is usually pictured something like this tree diagram down here. You'll notice that here's the bacteria, here are the archaea, here are the eukarya, and nothing is the ancestor, okay? Because there is no living species that would qualify as the ancestor of these three domains. Now let's talk about the common feature of all of every species in these three domains. They all share a common feature. We want to look at life and see how it works. To keep things simple, we will concentrate on the so-called free living cells, that is, single cell species included in the tree of life. We will also look at only those things that are common to all of life. At a minimum, a free living cell must keep itself going.
This means that it must make the necessary molecules to grow and reproduce. Along the way, it must defend itself against various threats, repair damage to itself, gather food and energy, and dispose of waste products. And it must be able to adapt to a new and changing environment, or else it will go extinct. One outline of these tasks of life lists some 130 functional categories grouped under about a dozen headings. Everything that goes on in a cell is controlled by the cell's genetic code. The genetic code defines and produces the carbon chains and molecules that carry out all of life functions. The way that a cell does this is called the central dogma. It was first described in the 1950s. It is very detailed and very complex, and it is essentially the same for all of life. The outline of the central dogma is this. DNA, which is the genetic code in the nucleus, is transcribed into RNA, another complex molecule, which is translated into proteins, which by enzyme action make the carbon chains needed to carry out life processes. And we'll discuss each of those items in turn. DNA is the code for everything that defines a species. It is short for deoxyribonucleic acid. Never mind. It is made up of hundreds or thousands of pieces of code called genes. Each gene gives the blueprint for a particular organic molecule. The DNA does not form carbon molecules by itself. The first step in the process is that DNA coding for genes is copied into another type of molecule called ribonucleic acid, RNA. Some of the RNA molecules carry the gene code for specialized molecules called proteins. These proteins, in turn, are used as enzymes to make carbon molecules of life. How does the central dogma work? Let's look now more carefully at the central dogma, since it's clearly key to the whole concept of life as we know it. The DNA holds a genetic code, which is unique for each species. Four carbon chain molecules called nucleotides form the genetic code. The letters G, C, A, and T represent the four nucleotides. They always appear in DNA as pairs, GC and AT, called base pairs. So here's an example of the spiral DNA molecule. Incidentally, it's a clockwise spiral. And if it turns upside down, it would still be clockwise. That's one of the unique things about clockwise spiral. The GC, these are the rungs in this ladder, so to speak, are the base pairs, GC or A and T. Here's TA, and here's AT. You can hardly read that, can you? But they're either GC or AT, all the way up and down the spiral. And those letters refer to moderately sized molecules, which I won't bother getting into. DNA is a long molecule built like a spiral ladder with a right-handed twist. The ladder sides are chains of sugar and phosphate, and the rungs are the base pairs. The sequence of the pairs determines the genetic code. Every protein, RNA, or other molecule manufactured in the living cell has its own defining code sequence recorded in the DNA. RNA is obtained from DNA by a copying process called transcription. All species produce RNA in this way. A special type of RNA molecule called RNA polymerase moves along the DNA and causes it to unwind by temporarily breaking the GC and AT links. One side of the DNA becomes a template that is used to build an RNA molecule that is identical to the missing side of the DNA, except that T is replaced by a slightly different nucleotide called U. Now, can I slide 11, please? An RNA molecule that codes for a protein is called messenger RNA, denoted mRNA. When transcription from the DNA is complete, the mRNA molecule moves away from the DNA. Proteins are made up of small carbon chains called amino acids. There are 20 different amino acids that can be specified by the DNA code. For example, here is the model of glycine, the simplest amino acid. All amino acids have an H2 at one end,
and COOH at the other end, and the different amino acids have different things in between.
And if you're really crazy, I can even show you what all of them look like, but I won't bother. Okay? The genetic code transcribed from DNA into the mRNA, the messenger RNA, specifies the exact sequence of these amino acids in the protein molecule. Bring back the previous slide. The code is read in groups of three called codons. The code may be read in a forward direction, up the spiral, as shown in this figure, or in the reverse direction. In this case, we're reading up the spiral. First codon would be GGC, which is glycine. Next one's UUC, which is another one. GAG, and so forth and so on. So the triples, every triplet of a nucleotide defines a codon. And in order to, okay. The interesting thing is that all living species use the same triplet codon scheme to specify amino acids, with only some minor variations in the exact meaning of a codon. But they're always in triplets. And that is really remarkable. When the fact that there were codon triplets used to define amino acids, there were some theoretical papers written which speculated, before they knew the exact details, speculated what that coding scheme would be. And there were all kinds of mathematical schemes proposed. But I don't think anyone, without having the experimental evidence, actually would have picked this one. It's a little different from anything else. Special molecules called transfer RNA, or tRNA, associate the codons to specific amino acids. So there has to be a tRNA that attaches to GGC. There's got to be another tRNA that attaches to UUC and produces that PHE, glycine. I forget what PHE stands for at the moment. Thank you very much. Okay. The proteins are formed as a growing chain of amino acids, slide 14 please, by a complex molecule called ribosomal RNA, rRNA. Typically, ribosomal RNA is a complex of 50 or more separate protein and RNA molecules. The ribosomal RNA molecule is one of the most complex molecules in a cell, and it's there for every cell of every species, from the very simplest species to the most complex. Typically, rRNA is the company. Yeah, the rRNA forms the protein chain by moving along the messenger RNA, growing the protein chain as it proceeds. This is called RNA translation. The following photograph shows many ribosomes building proteins as they move along the rRNA, the mRNA, these are rRNA ribosomes, building the protein. And this is a cartoon showing the process. You start at the beginning, and as you go, the protein you're producing grows and grows and grows, and eventually you hit a special triplet codon called the stop codon, which releases it, and then you're done. Next, I'd like to talk about enzymes. The central dogma would not work without the help of many enzymes. Enzymes are special molecules, usually proteins, that help many chemical reactions to take place. Without enzymes, the reactions would not occur at all. They would be much too slow to keep pace with the needs of the cell. All carbon chain molecules that carry out the central dogma are built using these enzymes. This includes the nucleotides, the RNA polymerase, the amino acids, the ribosomes, tRNA, and many other specialized molecules that are needed to carry out the central dogma. If a cell needs a particular molecule, it must either obtain it as food, which means some other living cell produced it using enzymes, or it must include the DNA code for that molecule plus coding for all the enzymes needed to build it. Enzymes hold molecules in a particular way so that certain reactions can take place, as illustrated in this cartoon. In this figure, the enzyme, which is the blue, joins two pieces of food called the substrate. So the enzyme has notches that hold the substrate and puts it together, and then it forms a product, which is a larger chain, for example. I'd like to give a homely picture of enzyme action by a little thread and needle picture here. You know, if you want a needle or thread and needle, theoretically, I suppose you could just sort of have the needle and the thread kind of wandering through space. And eventually, I suppose, once in a while, you will actually have the needle go the thread go through the needle hop. But that would not lead to many manufactured clothes. In order to actually have it be useful, you need an enzyme, namely my left hand, another enzyme, namely my right hand, and some electrical forces or some other mechanical means of bringing. So the enzyme on the left hand holds one part of the molecule, my right hand holds another part of the molecule, and if I can see, you put them together just so, and you have a threaded. But if this was done by random, without direction, without the enzyme action, it would never happen, or it would happen very rarely, not enough to be useful. So I like that picture of the needle and the thread as an illustration of enzyme action. When I was in high school, I was always puzzled by catalysts and enzymes. I never could figure out what a catalyst was. But now I know. It took only about 60 years. Okay. Let's go next to the... We're done now with the basic biology. I'd like to now talk about the size of genetic code. The point of this survey of the central dogma is that every living cell carries out the same complex process so that it can make the molecules that it needs to carry out its life functions. There is no living species in any of the three domains of life that carries out, say, only half of the central dogma. You might ask, why doesn't the DNA produce the end products itself? That would be much simpler, but there is no answer for this because there's no example. The only shortcut to this complicated process is to use organic food prepared by some other species. For example, humans need certain vitamins that their own cells do not make in sufficient amounts. Every living cell of every known species in any of the three domains of life, the bacteria, archaea, and eukarya, has to do all the things we've talked about and a lot more. This takes a lot of genetic code. How much? Well, in the past few years, scientists have sequenced the complete genetic code for a number of species. The following table shows the size of this code for a few examples that are of interest to us tonight. The size is given in the terms of the number of base pairs, that's the number of rungs in the DNA ladder, as well as in the number of genes, that is the number of specific molecules programmed for in the genetic code. The first entry, Mycoplasma genitalium, was the first species to have its genetic code completely deciphered. This was done in 1995. It has the smallest genetic code of any species. Mycoplasma genitalium is a harmless bacterium that lives in the human genital tract and also, I believe, in the lungs. Note that the simplest living species in the world needs nearly 500 genes and over 500,000 base pairs in its genetic code. Of these 500 genes, about 152 are needed just to carry out the central dogma. 55 are needed just to build the single ribosome that the cell needs. 24 are used for building tRNA. That's the ones that translate the codon triplets into molecules. 21 genes are used to make amino acids and so forth. Genitalium can get away with so few genes only because it depends on a rich supply of organic food for many of the molecules that it needs to survive. And so it's kind of cheating to say that that's the simplest living species and think in terms of evolution going from something from non-life to life, because genitalium can only exist if you already have a lot of organic food available. The next entry, Methanobacterium thermoautotrophicum, is, I spent weeks practicing that word, is the smallest known species that is an autotroph. An autotroph means it can manufacture all its own food from basic minerals and simple chemical compounds. It is a methane-producing microbe from the domain Archaea. So it's one of those strange new bugs called Archaea. And it is able to, self-sufficient. It can work without any other species producing the material it needs. Actually, that's not even quite true, unless it happens to also be a nitrogen-fixing bacterium also, as well. But that's another story. We'll get to the next talk. One can easily imagine that the very first species on Earth would have to be autotrophs, because there would not be any other living species to provide their food. But the size of the genetic code is a problem. In order to survive without organic food, the autotrophs require over 2,000 genes and 1.7 million base pairs, several times that of mycoplasma. The next species in the table is the Necocystis, presents us with another problem. It's from the phylum Cyanobacteria, sometimes called blue-green algae. It has chlorophyll that can convert sunlight into energy and uses that energy to make food in the form of sugar. Note that it is over twice the number of base pairs and genes as Thermoautotrophicum. These cyanobacteria are single-celled, but the cells reproduce by dividing into halves that remain attached at the ends, as you can see in the bottom of the next slide. That's a typical, microscopic picture of a modern cyanobacteria, and you can see they look like they're a multi-cell, but they aren't really. They're just single cells, and the reason, but they, when they divide by dividing in half, and then they remain attached. So you end up with something that looks like it's a multi-cell, but it really isn't. Here's the problem. Go back to the other side. I want to show, to say something more about that. The problem is, shown in the top of the picture, the earliest fossils on Earth look just like cyanobacteria. And these fossils come from a time that's just after the Earth first cooled to the point where liquid oceans could exist. How could such advanced species have evolved in so short a time? A time that is so short it's not even measurable. One might as well assume that life rose instantaneously. In other words, the very first life we see in the fossil record is already the third level in our complexity. It's very, very, very complex. Of course, we do not have actual genetic material from these first fossils, but it doesn't seem likely that they're much simpler than modern cyanobacteria, which have exceedingly complex genetic code, almost twice as large as Thermoautotrophicum. Go back to slide 16, please. The listing for E. coli is just included because it's one of the most studied bacteria in history, and I just put it there so you get a benchmark there. It's found in everybody's digestive tract. Okay, and it has over 4.6 million base pairs and over 4,000. Even a very simple thing like E. coli is actually something to be respected, because it's very complex. And there's reasons for that complexity, which I don't have time to go into now. The next entry in the table, Saccharomyces, is the eukaryote. Now we're in eukaryotes, with the smallest known genetic code. Okay? I think this is the first eukaryote we've mentioned. Okay? As we noted earlier, eukaryotes have a cytoskeleton that gives an orderly structure to the cell and supports an internal transit system. These innovations are needed to allow the formation of large, complex, highly structured cells compared with bacteria, and is the reason why all higher species, including plants and animals, are eukaryotes. All such species have DNA with over 12 million base pairs and almost 6,000 genes. Now, the next one is kind of interesting to us, I would think. Arabidopsis, Dopsis, thaliana. It has the smallest DNA of any seed-forming plant, of any flowering plant. Note another jump in complexity to 120 million base pairs and about 25,000 genes. Now, incidentally, when I say the smallest plant DNA, that's kind of has technical meaning to botanists. But I want to show you, let me just say another few words here. Thaliana is one of the wild mustards familiar as a weed to American gardeners. It grows throughout Europe and Asia and is closely related to the mustard that Jesus called the smallest seed in Matthew 13:32. And I want to show pictures of, if you've ever been driving through the farmland in the springtime, you have a fallow field, about May or June, you almost certainly see yellow mustard there. That is what's called the common mustard, the wintercress. The bottom is the what is most likely the biblical mustard, called black mustard. You see it's very similar. In fact, we have another picture in the back showing Thaliana in particular. These are sketches, and I find it easier to look at actual photographs and sketches. But anyway, that's called white mustard, and there's a Thaliana. I think Thaliana has a white does have a white bud, white flower, as opposed to white mustard has a yellow flower, as most mustards do. Anyway, since this species is the plant with the smallest genetic code, perhaps Jesus' remark is accurate in a deeper sense than many biblical scholars have supposed. If you look in Matthew 13:31, and it's in each of the synoptic gospels, the kingdom of heaven is like a mustard seed, which a man took and planted in his field, though it is the smallest of all your seeds. Yet when it grows, it is the largest of garden plants and becomes a tree, so that the birds of the air come and perch in its branches. That is repeated in the other Gospels also. And the interesting thing is, here's examples of various kinds of mustard. You can pass it around. Got yellow mustard, got black mustard, which is the biblical mustard. And for comparison, I have some poppy, which is also a seed they would be familiar with because of the size. And just look at the size of the various things. And since I don't have time, I have to blow the point before you've seen it. But the interesting thing is poppy is smaller seed than the mustard. But poppy is not as advanced a plant. Poppy is kind of a, the poppy bulb itself is kind of weird. You know, it goes in a bulb and has grows little holes and the seed shakes out of the, I don't know what it's technically called, but it shakes out of that thing. and whereas the mustard seed is a genuine flowering plant seed. And it is the simplest. In the DNA sense, it has the simplest, the smallest DNA of any flowering plant. I'm not going to go to the stake on this thing, but I will just simply notice that in verse 35 of that same chapter, Matthew 13, Jesus says, the commentator says, so was fulfilled what was spoken through the prophets. I will open my mouth in parables. I will utter things hidden since the creation of the world. The size of the genetic code of mustard has been hidden since the creation of the world until just a few years ago. And it is indeed the smallest of the flowering plants. To me, that's kind of interesting. As I say, it's not something I would go to the stake over, but it is interesting. The search, we're done with that table now. Go to slide 19. The extreme complexity of all living species should be a bit unsettling to those who hold to undirected natural evolution. The question naturally arises whether this complexity is necessary or whether it just reflects complicated fine-tuning of billions of years of evolution. In 1998, the National Research Council of the National Academy of Sciences held a symposium to look at the theoretical lower limits to the complexity of life. The symposium had the title, Size Limits of Very Small Microorganisms. The report was published early this year. The symposium looks at size limits dictated by physical and chemical as well as biological considerations, so it was a genuine cross-discipline effort. There are two answers to the question of size limits, depending on the kind of food that's available. If a cell can use organic food, that is, food that's prepared by another cell, then the DNA doesn't have to manufacture all of its life molecules. Thus, genitalium only makes one of its 20 amino acids, relying on protein food for the rest. On the other hand, if the cell has to make all of its own food from simple inorganic material, then the DNA has to include the genes needed to manufacture all the amino acids as well as the other life molecules. The symposium concentrated on the simpler case. In other words, assuming organic food is available. Its conclusion is the next slide, slide 20. Free-living organisms, this is from the symposium conclusions, require a minimum of 250 to 450 proteins along with the genes and ribosomes necessary for their synthesis. A sphere having a diameter of 250 nanometers, which is a nanometer is a billionth of a meter, constitutes a reasonable lower limit, size limit for life as we know it. Genitalium is not very far from this simplest possible life form. One symposium participant stated, active growing cells, significantly smaller than genitalium, are unlikely to exist on Earth today. In addition, the limit on genome size that accompanies small cell size guarantees that the cells of that size will have to depend on larger, more complex organisms for supplies of the small organic molecules required for their growth. Hence, a biosphere consisting entirely of ultra-small organisms is highly implausible. We're now skipping to section 7, next page. So here we are. We have just spent some time looking closely at the way that every viable cell, from the simplest to the most complex, carries out the central dogma. We have looked at the empirical evidence about the size and complexity of all living species. We have seen results of a symposium on the size limits of very small microorganisms, all of which clouds the question of the origin of life to a person who believes that life arose by undirected natural evolution. The overall impression that you must surely get is that life, at least the only life we can observe at present, is incredibly complex. Even the most basic process that sets up the production of the molecules needed to carry out the simplest cell's activities is so complex it is hard to imagine how it could arise by undirected random processes. Hundreds of genes involving hundreds of thousands of base pairs are needed just to carry out the central dogma. Hundreds more genes are needed to carry on cells' life functions. Ironically, even the production of the components of the central dogma depend on the whole transcription process being in place for their own production. How, one might ask, does one get started? But perhaps this apparent complexity is misleading. Perhaps far from being complex, the life we see on Earth is inevitable. That is what some biologists, such as Stephen Jay Gould, assert. To say that life is inevitable, and yet to know that there is only one kind of life, is in effect to say the appearance of contingency is an illusion. Does this make sense? Contingency is the idea that certain fixed features of life appear to be selected, either randomly or by choice, from a range of possibilities. Webster says that a feature is contingent if it is not the only possibility. That is, it is possible, but not certain. I want to illustrate the contingency with your little animal cracker. What kind of cracker do you get? Well, make a guess.
A dog.
A dog. Okay. How many got a dog? What kind do you have? Rhinoceros. How many got a rhinoceros? Okay. Anybody have a camel? There we go. I knew we had some camels there. Okay. Why didn't we all get camels? Because the choice that you made was contingent. It was one of a number of possibilities. Okay? Would you be surprised if everybody came up with a camel? Yeah, I would be very surprised. There are many The funny thing is, there are many contingencies that appear to be present in life as we know it, at least as far as we can determine. Could other molecules substitute for those four nucleotides? Could other amino acids substitute for the 20 amino acids? Why these 20 and no others? Could other elements substitute for nitrogen, phosphorus, and sulfur? Is the codon triplet scheme the only possible coding scheme? Is the four-stage central dogma the only possible building plan? Incidentally, as I said before, when they discovered the codon triplet scheme, mathematicians were imagining all kinds of schemes, of which only one, and not in fact the one that they had guessed, was the one that was true. And there are other things we haven't even mentioned today, because we don't have time. The fact that DNA and all the nucleotides have right-hand twists, but all the amino acids have left-hand twists. The use of a particular phosphorus-based molecule called ATP as a universal battery for energy storage. The universal use of a rare metal, molybdenum, and the enzyme nitrogenase to make nitrogen available for all life processes. The use of chlorophyll molecules to convert light to energy. The list could go on and on. What is there about life that requires these specific choices as the only ones used by all of life? The answer, as far as we know, is nothing. In other words, all these choices have the appearance of being contingent. It would seem that one could create entirely new forms of life, at least in principle, although it would be exceedingly difficult, by making some small changes in a few of these apparent contingencies. For example, right-hand proteins have been made in the laboratory. In principle, why couldn't an entire living species be made with right-hand proteins? There is no known physical reason why this could not be done, but the result would be an entirely new kind of life that we have never seen. Or perhaps the complex central dogma could be much simpler. Again, the result would be an entirely new kind of life. My response to this is, I'm willing to be shown. Show me. All of this gives some real problems to those who believe that life is a random product of undirected natural causes. Here are some of the problems that some such a person faces. How did life arise so quickly? If evolution makes any sense at all, then it must be based on a gradual increase in complexity. Any gradual scenario is seriously compromised by the apparent rapidity in which life first appeared on Earth. Why did life arise only once? The universal conclusion of biologists that life arose only once comes from the fact that many universal features of life appear to be contingent, which makes it implausible that exactly the same kind of life would arise more than once. Certainly life appearing all at once in all of its glory, even the lowly, simple prokaryote life, is not evolution by any stretch of the imagination. An ad hoc explanation might be that life is inevitable, given the hospitable environment. That's what Stephen Jay Gould asserted. But in that case, why did it arise only once? Or if it arose more than once, how is it possible that every line but the one that we have today disappeared without a trace? What viable but simplified versions of this? What are viable but simplified versions of the central dogma? An evolutionist must believe that radically simplified versions of the central dogma are possible. There are no examples around to point to, but they must have existed in evolutionary history. What are they? Even if the Earth environment has changed, the chemical and physical laws have not. So it must be possible to produce viable intermediate stages of life all along the line. If they survive to produce the current species, then they must be able to survive long enough to be demonstrated in a laboratory. I'm not saying this is easy or even possible with today's tools, but surely testable theoretical models must be out there to find. As far as I'm aware, the testable hypotheses that are needed to prove the validity of evolution are notably missing. This is not to say the hypotheses have not been offered from time to time, but as far as I know, they have not fared very well under close scrutiny, or else they have raised as many questions as they answered. So I'd like to conclude with a summary of what we have discussed. No simple life form exists. Simple life is a fantasy of wishful thinking. There is nothing simple about even the lowliest living species. The word should be avoided in discussions of life, because it implies something that does not exist. Similarly, the word the pro in prokaryote and the archaeo in archaeobacteria are misnomers, because they both imply an ancestor relationship that the evidence does not support. life substantially smaller or simpler than species found today does not appear possible as viewed by physics, chemistry, or genetics. There is a lower limit on size and complexity based not just on the observation of existing species, but on theoretical grounds as well. That lower limit is closely approached by the living species genitalium, which has over 500 genes in a DNA with 500,000 base pairs. Even to reach this minimum, it's necessary to take substantial shortcuts that require a rich organic environment to survive. No clear ancestral relationship exists among the major domains of life. There are at least three basic plans represented by the bacteria, archaea, and eukarya domains, but there is no clear indication that any domain is the ancestor of any other. All living species follow the same complex central dogma to build life molecules. There is no known practical or theoretical way to construct a viable life form that has significantly simplified versions of this dogma. Life appeared on Earth as soon as physical conditions would support it. The earliest evidence of life is recognizably similar to modern photosynthetic species. The modern species has a complex genetic makeup, and there is no evidence that the ancient species were substantially simpler. Many features of life appear to be contingent, and yet they are the same across all species. Every known species of life shares the same exceedingly complex building plan, even though this plan appears to have a number of features that do not appear to be predetermined by natural laws. One possible conclusion is there is no contingency. It's as if all is an illusion. But if this is so, then there must be some unknown natural laws that lead to a directed result. It is the evolutionist's burden to identify these unknown laws and to demonstrate them through effective experiments. On the other hand, if there is only one original life form, then the burden on the evolutionist is to explain the relationships between the domains of life and to suggest testable hypotheses to show how divergences arose. As I see it, the evidence we have looked at here amounts to almost overwhelming obstacles that a person who believes in undirected natural evolution must overcome. At the very least, there is a lot that needs to be proved and demonstrated. As one who believes that God created life, these features of life are confirming evidence of God's activity and show that life is the product of wisdom and intelligent design. Common features of species may or may not indicate common ancestry. An equally good possibility is that they indicate a common creator. Go back to slide 2 at the very beginning. Let's end by coming full circle. I agree with Hoyle's remark, his common sense interpretation of the facts. A super intellect has monkeyed with the physics, chemistry, and biology. There are no blind forces we're speaking about in nature. Thank you very much.
I'd like to field some questions, David.
Sure.
If I can answer them, Bart can.
You can eat the cookies. Yes, you may eat the cookies now. Yes.
You know, I saw that you also had a little reference to the so-called Martian bacteria.
Well, okay, I left that out because of time, but I'd be glad to go over that if you want. About the same time as, well, actually in 1996, just before the symposium, the NAS symposium, there were some supposed Martian microbes discovered. And can you get back to that slide, Brendan, find the slide which has the Martian microbes. It would be,
okay.
As soon as they were discovered, J. William Schultz, who is the scientist, the physicist, I like him a lot. I don't know him personally, but I mean, I like his writing a lot. Observed that in order for the Martian microbes to actually be living, okay, given his quote was the previous slide, I believe. Is that the one by Schultz?
No, this is what you're looking for.
He was observed that the Martian microbes are exceedingly minute in size. And he made this comment. They're 20 to 30 nanometer breadth. A nanometer is that's a billionth of a meter.
The minimum size required was 250 nanometers.
Okay, yeah, okay. Their 20 to 30 nanometer breadth is thinner even than the simplest bacterial cell wall. The living capacity would have been minuscule. For the Mars microbes to grow and reproduce, each of their biochemicals would have had to do the work of some 2,000 earthly counterpart molecules. Something is amiss. How could such tiny microbes live? And I believe personally, I don't know this exactly right, but I do know symposium was partly in response to the Mars microbes issue. And I wouldn't be surprised if Shope, he was a participant in the symposium, if he didn't precipitate that symposium being held, because he was kind of annoyed at the NASA scientists for putting this up as a living an example of a life form when, from physical and chemical and other reasons, there's no way it could be. That's basically what he would have said. Although they all say it very politely, because after all, they know which side of their bread the butter is on. I believe that Mars microbe business precipitated the symposium, in which they decided that no way. I have not yet seen any scientists say, because the symposium includes this, there's no way we could have had pre-life less complicated than what we have. But, okay, yes.
How do they know where the fossils came from?
They do it by analyzing the exact nature of the materials that the meteorite is made out of. And they know it's not from outer space. They know it's not, so where does it come from? Because each location of meteorites or comets has its characteristic makeup. Yeah, and I believe they did have some evidence of what the composition of Martian material is, and they believe this came from Mars. And it's from a physical point of view, it's possible that some stuff knocked off of Mars might have ended up on Earth. It's also possible that some stuff from Earth might end up on Mars, which leads Hugh Ross, for example, to argue, he thinks that they're going to find some microbes on Mars sometime. They'll have come from Earth. basically, that's what I'm not putting words in his mouth, but that's basically what he said, I think. Yeah. So the fact that someone discovers some fossils somewhere on some other planet doesn't necessarily mean they originated there. More to the point, these particular fossils were not fossils.
What I noticed is that most of the materials that are found in outer space are the same as were found on Earth.
Well, they are, because we all came from...
Different.
They are somewhat different. They differ in the makeup. There are some iron, what they call iron meteorites. There are... I'm not an expert in this, but there are various kinds of meteorites. Excuse me?
Nickel
ones, yeah, nickel cadmium ones. And some are basically earth type, granite types and so forth and so on. And more to the point, their radioactive dates are different. But they're all from the solar system, obviously. Yes.
Yeah. The isotope ratios in a number of them are distinct. So that's really how they... And we have a number of them we're fairly sure come from the moon, or a number fairly sure come from the asteroid belt. But these five or six meteors that they have found so far match the Martian surface very nicely.
Yeah. I personally have no problem with the possibility that the meteorites haven't come from Mars. I think it's amazing we could even determine that. But I have no problem with that. But I do have a slight problem with the microbes. Not my problem, Shope's problem. Shope, incidentally, wrote this book, which came out this year. It's an excellent book. I think this is the kind of book that ought to be in every high school library.
You want to read the title and offer that
book? It's called the Cradle of Life, The Discovery of Earth's Earliest Fossils by J. William Shope. And I will talk more about this in my next talk, which is another boost for my March talk. Yes?
Please repeat the question. I don't have any biology background, but that was fascinating about what you said about the amino acids and left handed versus right handed.
Yeah. Yeah.
Can you elaborate on that if there's any more?
The reason they have left or right hand side is because they're basically all built on tetrahedron shape. And remember I said there's the beginning part of the molecule and the ending part of the molecule is always the same, and the middle part changes. Well, that middle part makes an imbalance in the handedness. I mean, it makes it appear left-handed or right-handed. And depending on whether it comes on one side of the thing or the other side, it'll be left-handed or right-handed. But the way you see it is you get some of this material and you run a light through it, a visible light, and see whether it's polarized. It's going to be one way or the other way. Okay, the remarkable thing is all life amino acids are left-handed. There might be one exception. But they're not the basic amino acids, okay? All the amino acids are left-handed, which means if you put a light through, if you got pure of a given amino acid, you'd put light through it, it would look like it's spiraling to the left, okay? As you put a little shine of light through it. But if you tried to manufacture amino acids in a chemistry lab, you would get equal numbers of left and right-handed ones. They call it a racemic mix. And so the question is, if naturally produced amino acids are both left and right-handed, how comes life is always left-handed? You would think that you'd have some left-handed, some right-handed. I mean, you know, what is there? We don't know any physical reason why they have to be all left-handed. Then you say, okay, fine, they're all left-handed. We can make a new kind of life. Let's just make all right-handed, you know, use right-handed amino acids, you know, build proteins, and make a right-handed life form. I think, except for the complexity of it, there is no known reason why that couldn't be done. Maybe let's partners a reason.
I was going to add a little comment here. Right-handed and left-handed amino acids are mirror images of each other. You take them and fold them up, and you look in the mirror and you see them, but there's no way to take the right-handed amino acid and rotate it through any 360-degree type of rotation to produce exactly what you see in the mirror. They are asymmetric in their orientation, therefore they are mirror images. Now, one of the tricks that protein biochemists use to try to design receptor antagonists. Receptors are proteins on the surface of cells that bind a molecule and will transduce a signal to the cell to do something. One of the tricks that are used are to take a polypeptide sequence of 5 or 10 amino acids or whatever and change one of them. Instead of having the normal left-handed amino acid in there, simply put the right-handed amino acid in there. The answer is it dramatically changes the affinity of the receptor for that in terms of its ability to bind and the subsequent physiological signals that go to the cell. So the answer is, there's incredibly important physiological differences biochemically in the fact that a molecule is right-handed or left-handed. We don't understand why. Okay? It has to do with three-dimensional spatial orientation and the contact of various molecules, various atoms within an amino acid, within a protein, as they contact other molecules and proteins. But they are incredibly important. And when we manufacture peptide-based drugs, I work for a pharmaceutical company, one of the biggest challenges is that when you first do the process, you get what's called a racemic mixture. An equal proportion of right-handed and left-handed entities. And the whole field of chiral chemistry is built around trying to separate and to do directed synthesis. It takes phenomenal effort to synthesize something exactly with all left-handed amino acids right up front when we do it. It's really very complex. And so there's a big question mark there. Why these two should have developed? Why only left-handed amino acids were selected and formed functional proteins? We can't answer the question, but there is very real differences. Even though the chemical composition of a right-handed and left-handed amino acid, a B or L form amino acid, are exactly identical, atom for atom. They're the same size, the same mass, they have the same electronic charge. So none of that varies. Just its orientation in three-dimensional space is different. And the way in which it can fit together in a chain, they'll cause different kinking and shape in the chain, so they change the spatial dynamics. That's really the only difference, and yet there are dramatic differences in chemistry and in terms of functional consequences in the living cell. And so it is one of life's great mysteries, but it's a really important feature.
I'm now scratching the back of my non-knowledge. My understanding, I think that strychnine is a wrong-handed molecule, and that's what causes the poisoning from strychnine.
There's an occasional mistake in nature, but they're
incidentally, if you want to see some other pictures of mustard seeds, I have a bottle of them. Okay, I'm more than done.